Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 22 for October 27th, 2009. My name is David Liu, and with me today we have
Dominic Rabi
and Ben Snitkoff.
So we've got three really interesting stories for you today. The first is a new proposal by the guys at publicresource.org to put all of the laws online in a large federal repository. And secondly, we have a story of personal versus corporate liability with the founder of MP3 Tunes being personally sued as well as being sued as the company. And then finally, we have some interesting bits about anonymous contributions to AutoAdmit, which is a message board discussion site. So starting us off, we have this law.gov proposal. So currently, how can you find information online about what laws we have?
Not easily. So Cornell has a great website that has all of the federal laws and a handful of other resources thrown in there, but it doesn't have state laws. And as far as state laws go, it varies from state to state whether or not you can either, first of all, get them online at all, or secondly, get an official version of them online. And even Massachusetts publishes their laws online, but the laws say, you know, don't go by this. You know, if you want to make sure that you have the right laws, go somewhere else. This is, you know, we do our best, but we don't make any promises.
Various states have various websites with laws set up. You could also subscribe to LexisNexis or Westlaw and for significant fees, access laws through those services.
Yes, very significant. It's hard to underscore how expensive those are.
And do they provide any other services besides just what the laws say, or is it just the text that they're providing to you?
Lexis and Westlaw, they do have some things. Most of them have annotations, which it gives you the law, and then it gives you cases that cite the law and some explanation as to what the laws mean. But that's, I mean, it varies from state to state whether or not they'll have that. And again, that will usually cost you extra money on top of just getting access to it. The other things that Lexis and Westlaw have that are harder to find online but still possible sometimes are the actual cases. Each state has their own official reporter usually, and Lexis and Westlaw could give you access to, you know, all of the published opinions that are released from that state.
Yeah, it seems like a general problem is that we do have this confederation of states here, and there is no one set system between all of them. And what it seems like would be really useful, at least in my opinion, is if there was one centralized repository. And that's what we have in this story is Carl Matt. He was one of the main people at publicresource.org. And does somebody want to talk about what they do?
They basically try to organize all public resources in one place. The main way they've been doing it, there's this service called PACER, which stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. And this was founded maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And what it allows people to do is get documents of pending court cases as they're going on. However, the catch is that it's something like 8 cents a page, and you have to register for an account with the government. Usually lawyers, for example, have those accounts. What he's been asking people to do is he's been saying, hey, when you download your PACER documents for the cases that you're working on or the research that you're doing, just email me the documents, and that way I'll set up a central repository with all the documents. And that way the next time someone needs those cases, or someone who might not have a PACER account or might not be able to afford 8,000 pages, it's 8 per page, so it's 1,000 pages, which is entirely reasonable for a court docket, could run you quite a bit. So basically the idea is that if you just have everyone download or whatever they're uploading to PACER, because you also submit court documents via PACER, then that way people would have access to it through public resource and not need to go through PACER. In other words, it would provide free access.
Right. I want to jump in and say that PACER is only federal It only applies to federal courts. So you, if somebody files a suit in state court as opposed to federal court, you can't get access to that through Pacer. Recently, however, this guy did come out with something called Recap, which is a plugin for Firefox. And what that does is it kind of bootstraps this public resource site into Firefox. So if you have a Pacer account and you log into Pacer, what it will do is give you a little R icon next to any case where somebody has downloaded a document through using Recap. And what'll happen is instead of, having to click on the Pacer link and pay 8 cents a page, you can just click the R link and you'll download the thing for free from public resource. The federal courts have come out and said that if you're using a, they do offer some free subscriptions for not-for-profits and educational use. They said if you're an educational user and you install Recap, you're going to risk your license. You're going to risk your free use of this.
But for other users, there are there any legal issues for downloading it from public resource as opposed to Pacer?
They certainly haven't been threatened with any recourse, and I don't think that they're is any recourse that's reasonable right now. There is a question as to whether or not lawyers have a copyright on the briefs that they submit and the documents that they submit to court, but none of that's really been sussed out. So for now, you're going to be fine under the current state of the law, I think. Dominic, do you have any thoughts on that?
You mostly would be fine unless you fall into the specific category of like an educational user or something other something similar like that.
And you couldn't really claim the same thing for laws, could you? I mean, those are, as discussed in a previous week, I mean, those are facts, aren't they? Or at least not copyrighted.
Right, but lawyers submit briefs where they argue based on those facts, and their arguments based on the briefs are written originally. So those arguments, as they're stored in the briefs, are copyrightable because they're an original form of expression.
That being
Right.
said, there is a the U.S. government is not allowed to have a copyright accrue in any work created by the U.S. government, but it's not unheard of to have states try to prevent redistribution of laws by asserting a copyright over them or redistribution of regulations. I don't remember specifically how any of those cases turned out, or if any of them actually turned into cases, or if people just talked about it and figured out what they were going to do, but. I think there's an open question as to whether or not a state could assert a copyright over, over the laws that it publishes. Certainly, it could over something like guides to evidence. Like Massachusetts just released a guide to evidence. It's not an official rule set, but it's something that the people in Massachusetts worked hard on. It's a group of people who work for the Supreme Judicial Court. They assembled all these cases, they put them in a specific order, and they put a lot of work into that. And I think that deserves copyright protection, even if it's made up of stuff that in general are, is factual and not necessarily protected by copyright.
Okay, so this law.gov actual proposal, and reading from their website here, it's an effort to create a reporting documenting exactly what would take it to create a distributed registry and repository of all primary legal materials in the United States. So my question there would be, is does the, would this have benefit to, say, you guys as lawyers?
I mean, absolutely.
Certainly.
I will say it depends on how well all of this is organized, but generally, any free resource and searchable resource is a good thing to have. But one of the biggest problems that you have with laws is that, if you're searching for something about a horse stable, and what kind of regulation you need to go through if you want to open a stable, you may have to search for livery in the laws because that's how they used to refer to stables as back in the 1800s. So it helps to have somebody like Westlaw going through and tagging these things as horses, even though it says livery. So if you're looking for regulations about horses, you can go to a book or an online resource and go to Index for Horses, and it'll show you all of the laws that relate to horses. Meanwhile, if you did a Google search for that law, you'd never find it, and you'd risk a malpractice suit.
Pretty much.
And I think they also did say something on their website about finding some way to authenticate and create some additional information to go along with this, just the laws. And I think they were actually looking to students to sort of check in and see what sort of information they could add to the system.
Yeah, I see that right now. Another question I have about this, and it says a proposed register and repository of all primary legal materials in the United States, but aren't they submitting this proposal to the federal government?
Well, basically their idea is they're trying to do enough to shame the government into actually opening stuff up and doing work. What they did with the Securities Exchange Commission back in 1995 was Mr. Malamud basically did sort of a similar thing. He maintained documents for all corporate filings, and he put them online, and he actually did this for 2 years. And people started using this service. Then one day he decided to pull the plug on it and put up a sign that said, all right, I did this as an experiment. Go to the Securities Exchange Commission and complain and tell them to set up their own service, because I set this up and ran it for this long just to show that there is a demand for it, to get all of you using it. And now that I'm taking it down, you can go to the SEC and get and be angry at them and make them do something. And it actually worked amazingly.
Do you know if he had previously campaigned the SEC to do it on their own? Or
I think he had written them nice letters that went ignored.
That was a look of shock on my face there, in case all of your listeners couldn't tell. But, I mean, I understand that this may shame the federal government into making all of their opinions. And, I mean, they release a huge number of opinions from all of the federal district courts and federal courts of appeals every day. And all of the laws and regulations make that in one central place. But is this really going to help the small states, the states without huge budgets? I mean, I have trouble believing that, you know, they're going to be able to shame Tennessee or, you know, Alaska or Hawaii into putting their stuff online too. It's just, it's hard to think that they're going to have the clout to be able to do that.
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, the federal, in the sad state of the fact is that PACER is actually pretty good compared to what you have in state courts. Like, some state courts or city courts will even charge you money to run a search if it doesn't come up with any results, which is silly. But the law is unfortunately technologically quite backward, for lack of a better word. Lawyers aren't really known as the world's most tech-savvy people. Technology isn't something that they really embrace very often. There are many exceptions to this, but that,
especially the listeners of this podcast in particular.
So I don't know whether this is going to help with the state court thing, but basically at this point, anything is helpful, just because there really isn't that much.
Well, it seems to me that at least, I can't find it where it says it exactly, but part of the rationale behind this was to sort of create this, you know, structure and framework that could be expanded to lower levels, you know, I mean, basically open sourcing how these are published. And then, you know, in theory, that could make it easier for the states and municipalities to put their laws online without having to go through, you know, HTML hacking to put their stuff up online.
Well, I don't think there's really any HTML hacking going on. Most people just put up PDFs, sometimes even scanned PDFs, although with more and more electronic document submission, it's a raw conversion from whatever format, whether it's Word or WordPerfect, which is surprisingly prominent in the judicial field.
Yeah, I'm going to say tell me about it on that one.
Yeah. Are you using WordPerfect?
They are using WordPerfect at my current employer. Yeah. We also don't have electronic filing for all of our briefs at my current employer right now. They only have electronic filing for post-judgment briefs. It's another story. We can get into that later. Yep. Oh, yeah, WordPerfect. Sorry, you were in the middle of saying something else, Tom.
Yeah, I was basically just saying that it's not really HTML. It's usually PDFs and sometimes just even scanned PDFs, which aren't that great for searching. So it is really backwards in terms of what's available and what's out there in state courts. And I guess there's not that much demand for it because the lawyers that use it, these systems, a lot of them have been using these for 20 or 30 years, and they're perfectly, not necessarily the electronic systems, but they've been getting documents, printouts for 20 or 30 years, and they don't really need the change, and you have this legion of techie nerds who are like, oh, let's open the law, it'll be great. But they don't really know how the system works. And furthermore, the courts aren't really equipped to handle them or know what to do with them. And they kind of get scared when people are like, oh, let me have your entire database of law. And they're like, no, you can't have that. We'll charge you money for it. A lot of it is just sort of territorial almost.
Yeah, one more brief digression here. Last winter, I was working on a first-degree murder case out of New Hampshire, and we got all of our discovery in that case on CD-ROMs. And the CD-ROMs contained just flat-out scanned PDFs of deposition it was grand jury testimony, and it was extraordinarily frustrating because, like Dominic said, you can't search through it. I mean, we may as well have gotten a gigantic stack of files, you know, just printouts, because it was as useful to us as that would have been.
It sounds to me like that not only just would having all of this online have a ease of use effect on it, but it would also have a decent environmental effect in that you will not need to print out as many piles and piles of papers.
Sure.
Yeah, my one caveat would be that whether or not a lawyer likes to read stuff on the computer is still a very lawyer-to-lawyer decision. I mean, depending on what I do, sometimes I don't even like to read cases on the computer and I'll print them out. I'm doing it less and less, but sometimes you just want to be able to, you know, highlight something easier and keep multiple copies of it and write on it.
Oh, definitely. But there's also the fact that, you know, as opposed to printing out every document and then reading the one that you actually have, that you should be able to find the most important documents and then print that one out and highlight it.
Absolutely.
It'll be very interesting to see how the profession continues to evolve in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, especially with stuff like ebook readers becoming more and more popular. And just seeing as the technology goes in more and more and is embraced, and as we have a younger set of lawyers who grew up with technology. Public Resource, though, is definitely doing a good thing with their current project, and I wish them the best of luck.
All right, so any more thoughts? Do we think this will work?
It's certainly workable. It'll catch on somewhat. I'm not sure whether it'll get all the changes that they're hoping for, but
yeah,
hopefully.
I'm going to lean toward I hope it'll work, but I don't hold out much promise because I'm a cynic.
All right. Then I think we'll just leave that there and move on to our second story of the week, which involves MP3 Tunes. So MP3 Tunes is a website that sells downloadable music, and I believe you can also upload some of your music collection to it as well.
What I understand is they let people upload their songs to what they call digital lockers and then access them from any sort of web-enabled device like an iPhone or whatever.
But apparently EMI doesn't like that, so why wouldn't they like such a service?
Well, it depends on where the MP3 is originally from. Say if someone has a pirated MP3 and then uploads it or shares it, they wouldn't like that. The big thing that I think the record labels didn't like is MP3 Tunes, unlike almost any other music store, especially when it was launched in February 2005, it didn't use any digital rights management, which meant that if you downloaded an MP3 from MP3 Tunes, nothing would prevent you from copying it or putting it on Kazaa or the Napster of the day, or I don't even remember. Was it Napster around in 2005, or had it already been shut down?
I think it was shut down by then.
Yeah, it was definitely, I think it was shut down by then, but or on BitTorrent or whatever.
Okay, and so the interesting bit about this case is the fact that in this most recent lawsuit, EMI are they suing? Yeah, they're personally suing Robertson in addition to MP3 Tunes as a company. Why would they do a thing like that?
Ben?
Yeah, I wish I were that familiar with why they were doing this. So normally in a case like this, you would just sue the company because the company is going to have most of the assets. The company is going to be what's responsible. Who's responsible for this? Now, in certain cases, you can sue somebody who's behind a company. So it says here that he's the founder of it, which one of the reasons why you found a company is to give yourself some protection from this liability. Now, under certain circumstances, a plaintiff in a case like this will be able to do what's called piercing the corporate veil, which is basically reaching through the corporation and picking out one of the shareholders in the corporation and suing them personally. I don't understand why they're doing it here particularly. One reason to do it would be if the company was essentially bankrupt, or if the company itself wasn't doing anything. But it seems like the company and this guy are one and the same, essentially. What I'm getting from this is that he's making all of the major decisions that are affecting the litigation, but I don't understand what the tactical advantage here, unless this guy is independently wealthy in a way that I don't know about. I don't understand what the benefit would be for suing him personally.
He argues that it's basically sort of a way of discouraging any technologists from trying to do innovative companies that try to do stuff with music. He's just saying it's basically bitterness on their part, and they just want to show him that this isn't going to work, and we're going to make an example out of you so no one else tries anything like this ever again.
Well, this is also not Michael Robertson's first encounter with lawsuits based on MP3 based websites, because he is also the founder of MP3.com, and there were a number of lawsuits filed against him back in the day,
Yep.
and it seems that I believe it says here he cashed in for $103 million. So is his personal wealth falling into the equation here? The fact that he has money, whereas MP3 Tunes as a corporate entity might not?
It might be part of the reason behind.
Yeah, I didn't realize this. This guy's also the founder of the original MP3.com, Linspire, which did Lindows, the hugely successful Lindows and MP3 Tunes. Oh, Lindows. Sorry, it's bringing me back.
Yeah, MP3.com had, they paid out, I believe, around $100 million in copyright claim settlements. And then Universal actually bought out MP3.com for, I think, around $385 million. And I guess his share was like 103, that number that you quoted. So.
Yeah, so he may be more wealthy than we thought. I'd be sur Okay, I'm fine with that.
Okay, so EMI has this lawsuit against him. Personally, it seems like that he might get into a bit of trouble for it, but then again, I have no legal saying in whether that's true or not. What do you guys think?
One thing that's troublesome in this case is that the person that EMI deposed,
Emily Richards.
yeah, I was looking for a good way to describe what a deposition is. It's basically like testifying before a court, but you do it before the court case. You get put into a conference room with a bunch of angry-looking lawyers, and you ask questions day after day. Yes, so she testified in April of last year. Emily Richards did, and then she gave another deposition in July of this year. And in this one, she testified more to the fact that Roberts was in charge of making all of the important decisions. And she said that her testimony, I don't know if her testimony changed from one deposition to another, but this was included in this deposition. And
It did change.
sorry?
It did change. She gave she yes, it did change. She gave different, she elaborated more or gave different testimony in the
Yeah,
second
I mean,
deposition.
I think that's going to be an important distinction if this goes to trial, whether or not she just gave more information or whether or not she gave different information. But part of the reason she cites for giving more information or different information was that EMI paid her $10,000 to come and give the deposition, which included costs for coming to see the do that, her costs for her lawyer. By the way, folks who are listening, if you ever get deposed, it's very important. I know it's expensive. Hire a lawyer who will come in and make sure that you don't say anything extraordinarily stupid, because you can get in a lot of trouble with these things. Yeah, so that will go, among other things, to whether or not she's biased and whether or not her testimony is credible, and that'll all have to be determined at the time of a trial, or maybe a little before then.
Is it normal to get paid to give depositions in this case, or in general?
It's not entirely unusual. So with somebody who's a kind of neutral third party here, Emily Richards no longer works for the company, so if it were somebody, if it were an adverse party, they'd just, you know, give a subpoena and they'd have to come in, or, you know, they'd just agree to depose these people. For third parties, a lot of the time, like I said, it's a huge burden to have to come in to wherever the deposition is, to fly out the lawyers, to have your own counsel. It's not unusual to pay people to cover these costs. Now, one thing that's very important and you absolutely can't do as a lawyer is pay somebody for their testimony as opposed to paying somebody for testifying. And
right.
The difference there is, if I'm paying somebody to testify, I'm paying their costs, reasonable costs, to, you know, fly them out and put them up for the night and feed them while they're here. If I'm paying them for their testimony, I'm paying them a certain amount of money to say something. Whether or not that's true, I don't think it matters so much. It still violates rules of professional conduct. And specifically, if it's not true, it's suborning perjury. And it is a huge, huge ethical violation.
Could get a lawyer disbarred or worse.
Yeah. It would get you disbarred. And the worse is civil contempt, among other things, including jail time.
I'd be curious to know whether or not Emily Richards was paid for the first deposition. The article we were all looking at doesn't quite say that.
When she gave the first deposition, she was still working as president of the company, so it's unlikely that she was paid for it, but I don't know.
Yeah, she was almost certainly not paid for it. There would be rather large problems. So, for one thing, at the time, she would have been represented by MP3 Tunes Council, and possibly her own council if she wanted to, but MP3 Tunes would have been paying, you know, either their in-house lawyer or some big firm attorney to sit there and, you know, tell her what to answer and what not to answer. And I don't know if it would be unethical for EMI to help cover some of that cost, but it certainly was not the case. It certainly did not happen.
All right. Any other thoughts on this case?
I'm all set. Dominic?
All set as well.
All right, then I guess we'll move on to our third story, which involves AutoAdmit. So before we start, do either of you guys use AutoAdmit?
Never used it.
Absolutely not.
Okay, well, so as we are all not users of the website, I guess its main feature is the fact that it is a message board, but with very little or no moderation at all. And so that allows people, and the main audience for it is college students, and with, I think, their law students being the biggest audience that they have. And so the fact that it's not moderated allows there to be a lot of interesting things said on there. So, and in particular, we have this most recent case with two Yale law students who were apparently harassed, and there was a lot of derogatory comments posted about them. Does one of you have more information about that?
I think we'd like to keep our clean tag on iTunes, so I'm not really sure that we should comment on specifically what these are. Let's just say that they were less than polite company. Significantly less than what you'd want to use in polite company about these
two
women.
Ladies.
Yeah, two ladies. Specifically talking about their assets as attorneys.
Interestingly put. All right. So to avoid being sued ourselves, I think we'll leave it there. But so what action did they take to sort of remedy this defamatory comments?
Suing AutoAdmit.
And they also tried to sue the anonymous posters. Now, we've talked ad nauseum about why suing AutoAdmit won't work. Very briefly, that's because as a provider of an internet service, they have immunity under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which says that, very briefly, if you provide an internet service, you're not going to be held liable for anything that somebody posts on your site, regardless of whether or not you try to do any filtering. Now, the suit against the individual people was a significantly more interesting suit. Dominic, do you want to comment on that, or actually, Dave, how do you want to steer this right now?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that the case against AutoAdmit was not very. Yeah, I got nothing. Dominic, why don't you take it?
Regarding, so basically, from what I understand, they found out who some of these anonymous posters were, and they had their lawyers contact them, and then they went into discussions with these formerly anonymous posters, and apparently some of them settled, which is a good thing. They apparently got names for about 8 or 9 of the anonymous posters and settled with some subset of that. There's no details with how much they settled for or with whom they settled, but
Do we know how they got, how they figured out who the anonymous posters were?
I'm not entirely sure we know exactly how, but I could speculate.
Ooh, speculate, speculate.
I mean, generally, let's suppose, for example, they were posting from a law school computer at a certain time, they would be using an IP address. Perhaps, depending on how their law school had its internet configured, they might also be logged into an account, which means that they would be able to correspond their IP address to their user account and look through the logs and see who was logged in on that account from that IP address at that particular time. That wouldn't necessarily identify the person, but it could identify the computer at least, and assuming personal control over their computer or their account, then you could sort of go from there. And further, if there's a whole set of postings and there's a pattern, you can use textual analysis techniques to try to indicate authorship, especially across multiple postings. You could also just say, all right, well, this guy's from the same IP address, and this IP address is registered to Bob, and Bob lives there, and no one else logs into Bob's account from this IP address, so it's probably Bob. Let's write Bob a letter and see what happens. And perhaps that's how.
Yeah, one thing that I know happened is that subpoenas were issued in this case. So what they would do is they would tell AutoAdmit, who is a party in this case, at least in the beginning, give us at the very least the IP addresses of the people who posted. AutoAdmit turns over the IP addresses. The plaintiffs in this case go, to some internet searching mechanism and figure out what ISPs have ownership over those IP addresses and figure out who has that. And then what they'll do is usually tell the ISP, we're going to subpoena this person. So since they're currently anonymous, you need to either send them a, you need to send them a letter and say that we've subpoenaed their information. And it's at that point that the owners of that IP address, they're still anonymous, but they get notice that this is happening, and a couple of them hired lawyers to try to defend their right to anonymous speech, which, as we discussed on a previous podcast, your right to anonymous speech is not that strong when you're using that anonymous speech to libel somebody.
Okay, but it seems, and I can't find quite where it says it in the documents, but that AutoAdmit was not logging IP addresses. So what recourse do they have then? I mean, were they just figuring, if you just sort of infer from the contextual information of their posts who they might be, is that enough to pin it on somebody?
One thing they may have been able to do is if AutoAdmit, depending on how they register users, they may require an email address. And in that case, you could just directly subpoena AutoAdmit and say, well, give us the email addresses of these users. And in that case, it would be pretty easy to track an email address to somebody. If they're a Google, if they're a Gmail user, you get their email address and you can go to Google and say, Google, we're subpoenaing you to give us whatever personal identifying information you have about these people. That's actually probably a slightly easier way to go. Or, if they're like me, their email address is some variant of their first name dot last name at gmail.com.
So, what was the end game here for the two Yale law students? The case is now settled, I believe, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, the end game, I guess, in their ideal world would have been to, make up, get in a settlement, however much money they thought they would have made in their prospective legal careers that were almost undeniably tarnished by what was posted on the AutoAdmit sites. The end game actually was that they got some undisclosed amount of money from some of the people who posted the defamatory things. Dominic, any thoughts?
I mean, you pretty much summarized it right there. I don't think they're going to be suing any more of the anonymous people or trying to find out who else might have been involved. I think they just want to move on at this point and leave that chapter behind them.
So the settlement sort of seems to be, neither here nor there. I mean, does it change the field of anonymous commenters on blogs anywhere, or is it just sort of we'll have to wait until the next court? case to see if they get in trouble?
Well, I mean, it doesn't change the fact that you can still anonymously comment and make someone's life pretty miserable, but it does show that it is traceable, and that people will track you down and find you if they feel enough motive to do that. And I mean, potentially, basically, it's potentially not entirely anonymous. And that's, I mean, if it has a chilling effect on people being mean to each other online, then so much the better.
All right. Thank you for that. Ben, any concluding thoughts there?
No, I think we pretty much covered this.
Okay.
So this week has been kind of dry in terms of news, but we're going to finish up the podcast with a quick rundown of several other stories. There was a federal district court in Chicago that dismissed Cook County Sheriff Thomas's Dart lawsuit alleging that Craigslist facilitated prostitution. Basically, the court said that CDA Section 230, the Communications Decency Act, which we've talked about quite in detail, bars the sheriff's claim because Craigslist can't be liable for third-party online speaker content because it's the publisher, and as a publisher online, it has immunity under the CDA. Apple got sued by Nokia for infringing its patents. It's unclear exactly how and what, because we haven't been able to obtain the actual text of the complaint. But it's a story that we'll be watching, and we'll let you know of details as they become available, probably in future weeks. And finally, and this is sort of a fun note, Tony La Russa actually joined Twitter. If you might remember him from a defamation lawsuit or threats of one a while ago, he actually made an account now, and it is the real Tony La Russa.
Although you can't, I mean, that is the story that's out there. But I think one of the things that came out of the initial Tony La Russa lawsuit was the sort of added feature on Twitter of these so-called verified accounts. And as of right now, this Tony La Russa is not verified, although
that's true.
Everyone is reporting that it is, in fact, Tony La Russa. And he's promoting mainly his work with some animal rights groups.
Yes, he's only posted 3 tweets at this point and hasn't tweeted since October 22nd. So it's been a couple days.
But at the very least, now we know he's following Alyssa Milano's tweets. So that's very useful for all of us.
That is so incredibly creepy. Unless, is she a fan of the Dodgers or something?
She has her own line of, I mean, this is very technically relevant, but she has her own line of Major League Baseball fan clothes for women and girls. And so she's been in St. Louis promoting them before.
Okay, that's fair. Any other thoughts on this before we wrap this up?
Nope. Hopefully next week we'll have wonderful stories for us to share.
There is one thing that I wanted to mention. I think it's interesting that Twitter has essentially chosen at random the people whom they'll verify as a verified user. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to who they're verifying yet, or who they'll even let be verified.
Have you tried being a verified user?
No, I have not. Largely because I currently have something like 220 followers, and I don't think it's necessary. But like, I don't think, last I checked, Leo Laporte isn't a verified user.
Mm.
And you'd think that, you know, somebody of his quantum of internet celebrity would be a useful person to have verified.
Yeah, I believe Adam Savage of the Mythbusters, who has several thousand followers, just got verified recently as well. So it's, yeah, I mean, maybe there's some technical reason for why that's not being implemented on a larger scale. Or maybe, in fact, it's the fact that there are a lot more fake users posting on Twitter than we thought. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap this up for this week. As always, you can check out our website at technicallylegal.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at TechLegal. And yes, it is, in fact, actually us. My name is David Liu.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Thank you very much for joining us.